for me, living eyes wide open is living with recognition of, embracing the fact that in every moment we are deciding who we want to be and how we want to live our lives.
Your mind can be your most valuable asset or your biggest liability, and you get to choose. This is the Building Psychological Strength podcast, where we explore ways to build resilience, build confidence, and make our minds work in our favor. We draw from the fields of psychology and life design to help us intentionally create a rock-solid mindset upon which a vibrant life experience can be built. My name is April Seifert. I'm a psychologist, a life design strategist, and co-founder of Peak Mind, the Center for Psychological Strength. Each week, I'll introduce you to an expert, a concept, a technique, or a hands-on practice that will help you build psychological strength in your own life. These are the tools to help you thrive. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Building Psychological Strength podcast. My name is April Seifert, and I am your host, and I am over the moon, beyond excited, bursting out of my own skin at this week's guest. I'm so thrilled to introduce you to Mr. Isaac Lidsky. Isaac has one of the most eclectic resumes that I have ever seen, and let me just run through a few bullet points on it so you can see just how far-ranging and crazy this guy's background has been. Isaac was a child television star. He was on NBC's Saved by the Bell, The New Class. He played the regular character Weasel on that show. So if you remember that show, that was him. He also was a Supreme Court clerk for both Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. He graduated from Harvard at age 19. He's a very successful serial entrepreneur. He took, for example, an $11 million concrete subcontractor business that was hemorrhaging money, and in about 5 years, he took it to a $150 million construction services company. Now, all of those are incredible accomplishments that he has been able to make. He's only 40, but the reason why I stumbled upon Isaac and his work is because he wrote a book called Eyes Wide Open. You see, Isaac was born with something called retinitis pigmentosa. It's a rare degenerative disease of the retina. And from age 12 to 25, he slowly lost his sight. So he's legally blind today. And he wrote this book, Eyes Wide Open, as both, you know, a book to talk about the experience he went through when he lost his sight, but also, and way more so, to talk about the lessons that he gained as a result of going through that life experience. It's things that hit on so many of the topics that we talk about on this podcast. It's things like radical responsibility, taking responsibility for the situation you're in and being responsible for creating the next steps and the life that you want to have. It's also, you know, a book about self-acceptance and self-awareness and understanding who you are at your core and what makes you tick and when you can show up as your best and what that even looks like. Isaac has this way of putting into words some of the things that are difficult to grasp, concepts that can be so hard for us to understand, let alone put to work in our own lives. And he does such a beautiful job of it, both in his book. He also has a beautiful TED Talk that was viewed more than a million times in the first 3 weeks that it was out. So I'll link that up in his show notes page. Definitely check that TED Talk out. And he does such a nice job in this interview, helping us apply the lessons that he learned from his incredible life experience to something that we can all apply on our day-to-day lives. It's such a big deal for all of us to take responsibility for the time that we have to build the most vibrant and aligned life that we possibly can have. And I can't think of a better guest to have on the Building Psychological Strength podcast than Isaac, here to share the lessons that he's learned along the way with us. I'm so grateful that he's here. You guys, this is an immense treat. He is paid to speak all over the world in, you know, to give value like he's giving here absolutely for free on this podcast. So thank you, Isaac, for this incredible conversation. And I can't wait for you all to hear it. Isaac, it is beyond a pleasure to have you on the Building Psychological Strength podcast today. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure.
We were chatting a little bit before we hopped on to record. It's common that I get to speak to people who have written, you know, amazing books. It's not common, though, that I get to speak to somebody who's written a book that I have dog-eared to the point that it is nearly unrecognizable as a book anymore. So this is just a really big treat for me.
Well, thank you. That's kind. I appreciate it.
So for folks who maybe aren't familiar with your work or who haven't had a chance to get to know you, just a quick intro. Folks listening to this, Isaac wrote a book called Eyes Wide Open, and it is just, it's sort of the type of book that's all things, right? It's a book about you. It's a book about your background in a journey that you've gone through personally, but you've taken it in a direction that is applicable to everyone and contains so many lessons that we can all learn and live better if we apply to ourselves. So just to start with, I'm hoping that you can just give us a really quick overview of the book and get people excited about what's inside of it, because there's so much good stuff.
Sure. So, you know, for me, I had long felt that with the burden of blindness and the experience of losing my sight, which was very difficult and very painful in many ways, it also brought me tremendous blessings, insights, a vision that really has been among the greatest things that ever happened to me in my life. And so I long felt a need, a desire. I always knew that I wanted to get that vision out for others. The desire to do so really went through the roof when I became a father. And so, a few years after my triplets were born is when I really said, you know, it's important to me to make the time and space in my life to write this book, to get it down, and to try to share this vision that I've gained, first and foremost, like I said, with them. And also my fervent hope is that it can be of value to others, to people in the world and in their professional lives, in their personal lives, in their heart and soul. If it can help folks, that's a wonderful thing.
I love that. You know, I picked up your book because folks who've listened to this for a little while know I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when I was 14. And some of the effects that I experienced with MS, I experienced two bouts of blindness, both temporary. Each time happened in one eye, but I've always known that there's the chance that that could be something that happens again and happens in a way that is maybe more permanent or different than it had before. And I remember reading just a few pages of your book in Barnes & Noble, and I thought, okay, this is my guy. Like, this is my guy who went through a situation that I might someday have to face, and he is, like, killing it. Like, look at this baller. Like, he's the guy I want to learn from. But after reading the book, I realized how much there is even beyond that, for people who just want a different perspective to live their everyday life. And I'm hoping that we can get into just a little bit about what you mean by eyes wide open. Like, what does that perspective really embody and mean for a person just in their general life as they're going through and wanting to thrive and get the most out of life as possible?
Sure. Yes. And I am convinced, as you suggest, it's not about blindness or even, you know, quote unquote disability per se. For me, it's really ultimately about the sort of the human condition, right? So I guess in its simplest form, for me, living eyes wide open is living with recognition of, embracing the fact that in every moment we are deciding who we want to be and how we want to live our lives. I know that to be true from human experience. We know it to be true from countless examples of remarkable people that we see who transcend and thrive in the most awful circumstances. With science, as Western science is showing us, as this happens to be the case, Eastern philosophy seemingly has known this for a long time. But I mean, the bottom line is the one thing we have control over is our minds, right? And it is the one and only thing. And so when you think about it that way, you know, it can be overwhelming. It can be daunting. It's not easy at all. It's a practice discipline. It takes effort. But for me, at least, firmly convinced that, you know, again, we're choosing who we want to be and how we want to live our lives in every moment. That's, you know, if you believe that, to me, the rest is details, right? Step up and make those choices with awareness, with intention, with purpose. And so that, you know, that's, I guess, ultimately the message that I endeavor to convey in the book.
I just want to like take a moment of silence for what you just said, because if folks have listened to me for a long time, I love bringing people like you on because I swear I didn't pay him. Ah. I swear this is coming authentically from him and his book and his experience. It's something that I talk about so much. I released an episode maybe a week ago, week and a half ago, episode 139. It's called, all about the notion of radical responsibility. And that's taking 100% responsibility for 100% of the situations you're in, not necessarily accepting guilt or blame or fault. I mean, who knows? A lot of things can get you to the position that you're in. But here you are. And only you get to decide how you're going to move forward and what decisions you're going to make. And to your point, who you're going to be in that situation or any of the ones coming forward. You have so much control and so much ability to make those decisions intentionally.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, there's a Tibetan Lama that I like to follow his work, a man named Mingyur Rinpoche, a brilliant man. But he suggests that in a lot of ways, one of the tricky aspects of this sort of human existence of ours, it's not that this stuff is so complicated, is that it's really so simple. It's almost too simple. It seems like it's too easy to be productive. But nonetheless, I think there's a lot of progress in the idea that it is very simple at the end of the day. Again, you know, happiness is a choice. Well-being is a choice. Love, compassion, empathy are choices you make, and it's that simple.
Totally agree. Simple, but sometimes not easy to implement.
Not easy to do, but certainly worth the effort.
Exactly. And you mentioned this being something that you cultivate or almost a muscle that you strengthen. I can imagine, and I'm guessing here, but there's clues in your book too, so I have a little bit of insider info, but I can't imagine that was always the case as you began to come to terms with your diagnosis or understand what that might lead to. I think you were pretty young when you started to experience the very early symptoms of, you know, what would ultimately lead to you losing your sight. Can you talk a little bit about before you came to all of this, before you started strengthening that muscle, what was that mindset of yours and what were the thoughts and the feelings that were going through you as you were coming to terms with this?
Sure. So this is many ways in which, you know, it's, We tend to want to put labels on things. Was it a bad thing to go blind? Was it a good thing? Were there things just kind of are. But so anyway, I'm rambling. I'm 13 and I'm diagnosed because one of my older sisters is having some challenges with her sight. You know, I was diagnosed with this disease, essentially told you're going to progressively lose your sight and go blind. And this happened at a moment where, you know, in retrospect, it's plain as day. I didn't know the first thing about going blind or being blind or low vision at all. And yet that is not that's not where my mind went, right? The fear, you know, fear is this very pernicious emotion, this very sort of pernicious system we have where it does not abide a sort of deliberate patient response of, hey, I have no idea what I'm about to confront. Let me figure it out. No, it'll fill in the worst case scenario, mm-hmm. right? The assumptions. And so it wasn't a, hey, maybe I should learn about this. It was a, oh my God, of course, as I lose my sight and when I am blind, you know, that is going to be the end of life as I know it. And it's going to be this parade of horribles and, you know, there you have it. And I knew those things to be true, as misguided as they were. Then in a really remarkable way, as I was saying, you know, that the experience I had losing sight was sort of itself produced the aha moment. So I lost my sight slowly and progressively, like I said, over about a dozen years in a way that produced all these bizarre visual effects. a way that really exposed as a illusion, a miraculous illusion, this experience we have of sight. We think that we open our eyes and it's this passive thing. Seeing is believing. Sight is true. Sight is something that happens. It's just in your eyeballs, and it's all that simple. Well, the reality is completely different. I mean, sight is this entirely virtual, unique, personal slice of an experience that you create for yourself all in your mind, but then you believe it to be true, fact, indisputable, objective, beyond your control. And the moment of realization for me, the blessing for me, really came when I thought, you know what? Sight is – that's not the only thing that we just sort of make up and believe, right? In fact, you could say sight is a great example of it, but it's really a good way to sort of describe human existence writ large. That's what we do. We take in a lot of inputs and we put them through a database of past experiences we've had, and then we tell ourselves a million stories. We just make up stuff that we believe all day long, left and right. And for me, it was just so visceral to realize that that is what the sort of reality of my fears that I was living in, this feeling like I was trying to squeeze as much out of my life as I could while I still had sight, and race against time. And I was convinced I would never marry, I would never have kids. You know, it was literally just stories that I had made up and chosen to believe. The terrifying thing is, if when we're not aware that we're doing those, that we're making those choices, then they're self-fulfilling. If I had not, I think, seen clear to take responsibility, take control of my life, live eyes wide open, as I like to say, I'm pretty sure that sort of doom and gloom scenario that my fear, was selling so hard, kind of would have been my life, just almost by default. And so that's the shame of it. And so, for me, what was a very agonizing, painful, long process of slowly losing my sight, ultimately towards the back end of it, became this very liberating new perspective, this sort of glimpse of a way that I could choose to live my life, that ultimately, again, was a real gift. I wouldn't trade it for anything.
That is so similar. It's funny the way that the words that you use to describe the things you knew about what your future would hold, right? The things that you believed to be fact and true, that you would never get married, that you would never be successful, all of that. I had the same exact fears and knowledge, like beliefs that I thought were rock solid when I got my diagnosis and when I was extremely sick. A lot of different issues at the time, both sight and gross motor and fine motor and balance. And I mean, you name it. I was kind of a mess back then. But I had the same belief system. I knew that I would never get married. I knew that no one would ever love me because I would be a burden. I knew that I would never have a successful career. And you're absolutely right that we convince ourselves of these things. And I've spoken about this on previous episodes, but it relates so well here is that our minds are so incredibly powerful in that they'll goal seek for us. Meaning if you put a picture or a goal or something in your mind that you want it to find for you, it'll do it. And that can be a terrible picture. It can be a really awful set of circumstances, or it can be a really amazing one. And that's where people don't realize that if you set your sights on something, this isn't, people believe a lot of different things in terms of how our minds work and all of that. But purely from a cognitive psych perspective, if you put a goal in your mind or a vision of something that you want to achieve, your mind's just automatically going to try to find things that are congruent with that. It'll point out little details. To your point, it'll construct a vision of what your world looks like that's in line with the thing you're telling it to go find. And you get to pick what that thing is. And that's incredibly powerful.
Yeah. It's pervasive it's the same mechanism that tells us we're too fat, too skinny, too tall, too short, not enough of this, too much of the other. These are just ideas. And the more we tell them to ourselves, well, The more we tell them to ourselves without being aware of the fact that we're telling them to ourselves, then we start to believe them.
Totally. Totally agree. Life can be so much more than simply going to work and waiting for the weekend. But deep down, you already know that. You know that life can be so much more vibrant. You know you were made for more than just passively going through the motions. You know you can thrive, but to do that, you have to start from the inside out. And that is why I'm so excited to announce that for a limited time, we're offering you the opportunity to join us in the Peak Mind membership for only $1 for your first month. That's right, $1 to join us in the full Peak Mind membership. All you have to do to take advantage of this amazing offer is to visit us at www.peakmindpsychology.com, click on the membership, and enter the code THRIVE at checkout. Think about it. We all know what we need to do to keep our bodies strong. But what about our minds? What if you had the tools to build the psychological strength, confidence, and resilience to help you thrive at work, at home, and in the rest of your life? What if you made the commitment to living your life by design and not by default? All of this is possible. The goal of Peak Mind, the Center for Psychological Strength, is to help you build the mental toughness, flexibility, and resilience to thrive in your life. We draw from the fields of psychology and life design to help you intentionally create the vibrant life experience you know is possible. Through live online workshops, a 24/7 on-demand library, expert interviews, and monthly challenges, our members are building the psychological strength that it takes to thrive through life's ups and downs. And like I said, you can do it too. For a limited time, we're offering you the opportunity to join us for only $1 for your first month. Just visit www.peakmindpsychology.com, click on the membership, and enter the code THRIVE at checkout. Your mind can be your most valuable asset or your biggest liability, and you get to choose. So what choice are you making? Join us in the Peak Mind membership before this amazing offer goes away.
There's a section in your book that I think is particularly powerful for people as they think about how to live their day-to-day lives. Because sometimes it's interesting, because sometimes people who listen to this can come from a perspective of, if I'm interviewing someone who is incredibly successful and incredibly decorated in one way or another, they can say, oh, you know what? That doesn't apply to me because I didn't have, you know, the money that that person did, or the connections that that person did, or I didn't have the same opportunities. In contrast, I've spoken to people who have gone through incredible adversity, a woman who survived the Holocaust, and people who have gone through cancer, and you name it. And people can find similar reasons why this stuff doesn't apply to me, because, well, you know what? I'm not going through something that is that arduous, and so this doesn't really apply to me. But across the board, it all does. These are the basic foundational principles of what we can do to set up a life that is one that we're thriving in, whether we're in a time that's up and whether we're in a time that's down. And so I want to make that really clear for people, that so much about, you know, what I've learned from you and from your book, it applies so much more to my day-to-day life than it ever has turned out to apply to, hey, how do I think about what might happen to me with MS? One particular part of your book that I'd love to dig into is the chapter where you talk about the difference between acceptance and surrender, because it really hits home about how we limit ourselves without even realizing it. So I'm wondering if you can just give a little quick blurb about what you think about the difference between acceptance and surrender.
Sure. So, I mean, to me, it kind of boils down to a zealous, uncompromising commitment to really be honest with myself when I stray into the territory of can't, you know, versus don't want to, versus might not want to right this second, versus maybe do want to, but I'm afraid, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In the ambiguity that we allow in sort of swapping out what are very fundamentally different questions and different situations to find ourselves. And in that ambiguity, I think acceptance often really erodes into surrender. I can give you the example that I one of the examples I should say that I share in the book is when Dorothy and I finally brought our triplets home from the hospital, and newborn triplets, there's a lot of work to be done, a lot of diaper changing, a lot of bottles, a lot, et cetera. And, there was a moment where, I sort of came close to sort of begging off and had to sort of catch myself. And so kind of to walk you through the sort of internal questioning that I go through, it was what I said to myself was, look, if it is the case, there is no question that being blind adds a level of complexity and burden, let's say, to the task of changing diapers and bottle feeding, et cetera, et cetera. If I want to say for who I am and my priorities and what the nature of my deal is with my wife and how she expects me, if it works out that I can be like, I'm going to beg off and I'm not, shirking any responsibility, that's fine. Like I can be like, I'm blind. It's going to be a lot more work for me to do this kind of stuff. It's not necessarily worth it to me it's not my thing. And my wife is cool with it. Fine. But what's not okay is to sort of tell yourself that's kind of what you're doing. When the reality of it is, as it was in my case, when I really, dug down deep, the reality was that I very much wanted to. It meant a lot to me. I very much wanted to be an active participant in caring for these babies, especially after the challenges we went through in getting them home healthy and whatnot. So, then it becomes, well, then why not? Well, because this is a pain and it's a burden and I'm a little worried about it. So, well, that's not a good enough answer, right? By the way, how many other times in your life have you confronted pains or burdens or hassles and you figure it out? And so for me, again, it's really I really want to stress, it's not a judgmental framework of you should do this or you shouldn't do that or but it's you. I guess now the one counterexample, the one exception is you should be honest with yourself at all costs, because when you start telling yourself you can't do something or you really don't want to, but what's going on is maybe there's some fear or some concerns about sort of practical reality. That's when, again, you start surrendering to your circumstances and saying that who I am and the choices that I want to make and what I want to do is sort of is constrained by forces beyond my control. I fundamentally don't believe that's ever the case, right?
I totally agree. There's this passage, one of the passages that I underlined in that chapter before I stopped underlining and then went back to the beginning of the chapter and wrote, just read this whole thing over again, because it's dumb to underline every sentence. But it was, the danger lies in the self-limiting assumptions you make about yourself, the disadvantages you create. And that was powerful, because what you're talking about is, it's almost this system one, system two, our automatic mind versus our more deliberative mind. You're saying, we can't really control very easily the fact that our automatic mind, the fact that this reptilian side, this very old side that wants to keep us safe, is going to jump in and like loudly yell at us like, no, this is really hard. You should just be scared and like not even try. This is too difficult. You can't do this. You can't handle it. That's going to happen.
In some instances, your body, the amygdala is producing the physiological response in your body. You are physically responding before your prefrontal cortex has even had an opportunity to process the input.
Yes, yes. What I tell people is, the areas of your brain, so you talk about the amygdala, right? The areas of your brain that are absolutely critical for you surviving, they have a few characteristics. They evolved a long time ago. Like historically, when organisms started developing brains, they evolved a long time ago. They are also almost completely developed, if not completely developed, when we're born. So early in our lives, they're fairly automatic and they're hard to disrupt. And so the biggest example of that is the parts of our brain and our brainstem that cause our heart to beat and keep us breathing, right? Organisms have to breathe, they have to circulate. So these are very old parts of our brain. They're also automatic, meaning we don't die when we fall asleep because we forget to make our heart beat, and they're hard to disrupt. Shortly after those areas of the brain evolved, the amygdala came in. So that fear response is extremely old, and it's there almost almost the moment we're born, we have that response, that physiological response, and it's automatic versus the frontal cortex that you talked about. I mean, I don't think that's fully developed until you're 22, 23, and it's a relatively new part of your brain. We're bad at it as a species. We're not that good at it. And it does it. Our amygdala jumps in, and that's the first thing we hear and feel. But a lot of people stop there, and they don't go through what you just said.
Yeah, and as I try to explain it to myself, frankly, and my children, and it's like the difference. It's this fundamental flaw in our logic. We tend to view emotions, intense emotions, really as output of us. When in reality, they're meant to be at our best. They're inputs. They're meant to signal to the part of us that makes us human, right? Our neocortex, the part of us that can make judgments and resist temptations and whatnot. They're meant to suggest, hey, in the case of fear, hey, this is something that is important here. Focus up. It seems to implicate major things for you. In the extreme case, survival. As an input, that's wonderful. That's very valuable information. Now, you have the opportunity to take a second and stop and think about it and say, well, why do I have such an intense fear response? And with practice and with deliberation over time, I think meditation helps, but it's not necessary. But you can get to a point where you can start to really learn a lot of insights about yourself. And maybe I'm reacting in this situation because it's actually triggering a memory from something that happened with someone else or in childhood or in another thing. And man, I'm so glad I took a moment to think through this because I, for a second there, almost reacted blindly in a wholly inappropriate way to someone that I love dearly. And I could have done something that would have been very hurtful to them. Mm. That's what makes us human. We get to stop and think. So, you know, again, I'm rambling, but to me, emotions, they're inputs, not outputs. They're meant to signal information to us, and then we get to decide what we want to do with them.
I don't think it's rambling at all. I think it's a point that needs to be hammered home often and frequently, because we posted forever ago on our Peak Mind Instagram this quote that I think gets glossed over so quickly, but it is so powerful when you think about it. And it's this exact conversation. It's, you don't have to believe every thought that you have.
No.
Every thought that your brain chucks at you, most of them are overly protective, old responses that you can take a moment and question them. You don't have to believe it immediately.
Absolutely. And by the way, you can even step into, embrace the fact that as an organism, us humans, we're kooky, man. Thoughts think themselves. I totally agree. We don't control the thoughts we think. They just pop into your head. So I firmly believe if you're in the enterprise of trying to stop certain thoughts or change, it's the wrong way. You almost got to go the other direction and say, I'm going to be aware of them all and embrace them, but be conscious about what I do with them. But yeah, so thoughts think themselves, and we're predictably kooky, right? For example, I love the research that shows, you know, 95% of people will say they're above average, right?
Like I love it.
Like on, you know, math, history, whatever. So it's like, well, yeah, to your point, okay, somewhere along the way, evolutionary psychology, whatever, it was valuable for us to dream big, be bold, have a lot of confidence in ourselves. That's wonderful. But we know it's there, and on and on and on and on and on. So, you know, again, thoughts think themselves, emotions are often thrown into the mix before we are even conscious of the circumstances that are triggering the emotions. It's a wonderfully complicated mess that is human consciousness.
Exactly. Exactly. And if you can approach it with a little bit of a sense of humor, a little bit of a sense of humor, like, okay, that's adorable. I know we're afraid right now, but, you know, let's just start to pull this apart. And something that you mentioned before, I've been in hard situations before. I've always figured it out before. We have a hard time giving ourselves credit for that you figure, like, all of the hard days you've had so far, you've somehow figured out a way to survive through them. You're probably going to be okay.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about how this has manifested in your career, because your career has been, you've got the craziest resume. I mean, really crazy resume. But you've done some incredibly difficult things in your career. And I don't know what stands out more for you. I mean, I've read about, you know, your construction company and building that up and turning it around, whether it was, you know, the work that you did with Supreme Court justices, like how has this woven its way into some of those other areas of your life and helped you succeed?
So, you know, if you say, you know, if you buy everything that we've been talking about so far, right, then I suggest a logical next step is, you know, again, simplicity is often a good place to start. What are the basic questions to be sort of asking yourself? Well, what do I want to do with my time? Like, how do I want to spend my time? To me, to have a career, what does it mean? Are there aspects of being an employee that are me? What kind of employee do I want to be? What kind of a colleague? What kind of a boss? And what kind of a parent do I want to be? What kind of a, you know, how do I want to spend my time? What do I want my life to look like? Is it art, creativity, business, you know, whatever. And then I feel that, you know, we owe it to ourselves. We're not here very long. And so I think we owe it to ourselves to do our best to try to vindicate our answers. That's, I'm a recovering lawyer, as you know, one of my chapters was in maybe this is a lawyer's way of embellishing the point that, for me, I've been blessed to do a bunch of different things because as my life circumstances change, before I met Dorothy, I was in one position, and then I met Dorothy and we fell in love and we were young and had no kids and then we had kids. And so, you know, life changes, people change, priorities change. And whether I have no attention span or whether I'm, you know, sort of a determined to do what I want to be doing. I mean, for me, how that's played out is every, you know, 3-4 years, it seems 4 or 5 years. I kind of find an opportunity to start a new chapter professionally. And it's been wonderful. It's been very rewarding for me. I like to create new things. I like new relationships, new problems, new challenges. And so it's been wonderful to kind of move along from one to the other. It has produced, admittedly, I will confess, what appears to be, you know, the resume of a schizophrenic person. But you know, it's worked for me, and it worked for me and my family, and that, I mean, that's the point, right? That's the ultimate point. I'm not suggesting it should work or could work or might work for anybody else, but for me, it makes sense, and I'm blessed to have a wife who is infinitely supportive and understanding, and she just kind of rolls along with it. So if it works for her and it works for me, you know, that's how we do it.
What you're talking about is this intentional approach to, you know, what you're going to do with your time at any given point. And I think sometimes people get really stuck in who they were before, or people like me do this, that, and the other thing, or people like me can or can't, or shouldn't. And it goes back to the set of assumptions that you talked about before. We make the assumption that what we've done before is what we have to do going forward. And somehow the decisions we've made, even years or potentially decades in the past, are the ones that have to dictate what our life looks like going forward, and they really don't. When you question that, and when you start to flirt with other options and sort of cheat on your old life and explore other paths, it's incredible the opportunity that comes in front of you.
Yeah, I mean, with obvious exceptions aside, no one's making you do anything. And this is the message I tell myself. So if it sounds overly hard or overly demanding, I promise I apply it to myself too. But nobody's making you do anything. So if you are unhappy, dissatisfied, frustrated, unfulfilled, it's on you. Nobody's making you do anything. Also, nobody's stopping you from doing something about it.
That's so true. Because if it's not on you, who is it on? Who are you giving that control to?
That's exactly right. And by the way, there are often times where we want to believe that we can invest in others' control over our own lives. It often, in some circumstances, it's more comfortable, it's safe, or it feels at least you don't. Then you're relieved of the obligation and responsibility. Even if you wanted to, you can't do it. It's just not the human existence.
Yeah. And I'll add another overly harsh thing right on top of that, because this is, again, to your earlier point, This is what I tell myself a lot of the time. So you're in this difficult situation, right? Here you are, you've got maybe too much work or the wrong work or this pressure or that pressure or whatever. No one's coming to save you. Like no one's going to swoop in and save you from this situation. So if you don't like it, what are you going to do from here?
Yeah.
What move do you want to make?
In one of the chapters of my book that's about fear, I talk about heroes and villains. And, I think it's exacerbated by fear, but I think it generalizes. We invent heroes and villains for ourselves in all sorts of contexts. I guess I'll make the observation that the heroes can be, in some respects, even more pernicious than the villains.
Agreed, because you're sitting and waiting around for them. And sure. To your earlier point, time's the most non-renewable resource that we have. We only have this finite amount of it. And if you're sitting around waiting to be saved versus, taking your life by whatever, the horns, I don't know. That's not a good analogy, but sure. So as we're kind of, wrapping up today, I'm wondering if you can give us, if you could impart wisdom on the folks who are listening to this, on this audience, and give them directive of three things that you would suggest that they do, or three questions to ask themselves, or ways of being that they might, that you'd want them to take away from either your story or what you've learned or this discussion today. What would you have people go do in order to put this into action with their own lives and live a bit better as a result of what you've learned?
Yeah, so definitely, the quote unquote corny or cheesy questions that seem, quote unquote silly, or you want to roll your eyes. Maybe think again about that and go the other way and try to ask yourself those questions a lot and think about them time and time again in different circumstances, when you're happy, when you're not, when you're at work, or and really try to understand, because if you don't have a good understanding of what it is you want and what success looks like, then man, it's not going to happen for you, right? So you got to start there. The second thing I would encourage folks to think about is the idea that the true nature of our existence, right? Not to go too metaphysical or whatever, but we have everything we need all right in our, in our body, between our bodies and our minds, heart and soul. We have everything we need. When you think about what it is that gives you happiness, joy, peace, satisfaction, when you really sort of pick it apart, it's none of the junk out there that we pay so much attention to and we focus on so much. And so take some time to sort of go inside yourself and figure out what makes you tick and how you operate. And again, what is peace, what is joy, what is happiness look like for you experientially? Because I firmly believe that we have these poor proxies that we chase, and then we're surprised when they don't sort of produce the intended effect. But anyway, so that would be the second thing. And then what's the third thing? Well, I guess maybe the third thing is you touched on it earlier, but this notion of humor and this sort of I tend to counsel people to try to avoid drama at all costs. I mean, life is funny and messy and honestly profoundly insignificant. I like to say graveyards are full of indispensable people. So, if you're not having fun along the way, you're already losing.
I love all three of those. There's eons ago, it seems like now, I was dabbling with this blog and I wrote this post called The Big and the Small. And from the big perspective, meaning from the perspective of how many people live on the earth now, how many have lived here already, how many will live here, say, in the next, few generations, what is your one life divided by that number? No one cares. Like, no one actually is really paying that much attention to your missteps or anything that you might do that's not that perfect. Because look at all those people. There's not enough energy to go around for that. But if you look at it on a small perspective, that one tiny thing is really all you're going to get. I get metaphysical in that way too. about just the awe and the significance of the one shot that we're going to get here and making the most of it and having as much fun as you possibly can along the way. So high five through, you know, awesome. The internet.
Love it.
Last question I want to ask you is about psychological strength. I'd love to hear how you would define it or how you would think about being psychologically strong in your own life.
The question I haven't given much thought to. Psychologically strong, this notion of sort of self-honesty, introspection, self-awareness, I think is really, you have to start there. I don't think, to me, at least logically and in my experience on this earth, psychological strength must begin with introspection and self-awareness and honesty. And just a willingness to say, I am who am I, who I am, and that is okay. It is wonderful. And maybe there are all sorts of other things that I've told myself for however long that I wish I was better at or worse at or different at, but I'm not. And then, hey, maybe there are all these other things that I am quick to dismiss or overlook and whatever, but they bring me joy. But I am who I am, and I understand who I am, and I'm okay with it. I'm wonderful with it. That's where it all starts, I think.
I totally agree. This has been just a pleasure to get to chat with you, to get to pick your brain on some of these, you know, aspects of life that are so incredibly important, and really to be able to push your book out there in another, through another medium, because it's just been such an impactful book that I've read for my own life. And I hope that everyone listening to this runs out and grabs a copy of it and gets just as much value out of it as I did. It was just such a huge gift that you've put out there in the world. So I want to say thank you for sharing your story, for being open about it, for also being so thoughtful and articulate to be able to say things both in the book and here that we have a hard time putting into words and putting into action. So, you know, we look to people like you to be able to help us do that a little bit better and live better lives. So thank you so much, Isaac. This has just been phenomenal.
It is truly my pleasure and privilege.
It's a simple fact that nearly everyone in the world could benefit from building psychological strength, but not everyone will put in the time and effort to do so. But today you did. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Building Psychological Strength. Now, if you're interested in building the mental toughness, confidence, and resilience you need to thrive through life's ups and downs, visit us at www.peakmindpsychology.com. Also, if there's someone in your life who could benefit from this episode, please share it with them. And if you yourself found this episode valuable, meaning if you took away even one insight that you can use to build psychological strength in your own life, we would so appreciate it if you would drop us a rating and a review on iTunes. The thing is, the more ratings and reviews we have, the easier it is to get this powerful and important content out to the people who need to hear it. Remember, your mind can be your most valuable asset or your biggest liability, and you get to choose. So choose wisely, my friend, and I'll see you next time on Building Psychological Strength.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.